hope, resurrection in the face of death.
If I can just vent a bit here.
The question is, what is right in the sight of God?
Church is essential to being a human.
Well, well, well. Yes, yes, yes. The time is now. The place is here. Welcome along to another episode of Irreverend with me, the Reverend J.A. Franklin. And as always, well, most of the time anyway, it's my good friend, T.J. Pelham. How are you doing, T.J.?
Oh, good, Jimmy. I've just driven quite a long way today, so I'm feeling a bit post-drive, you know, how that is. I don't know. It's hard. I don't really feel that way any other way. Post-travel. It's very exhausting.
Yeah.
And there was no milk in the fridge when I got back, so I had to have a black tea, which is obviously distressing. But other than that, I'm in good mood because, I had a lovely few days, so it's good.
Yeah, and we saw each other, didn't we? So don't worry, everyone. We didn't touch each other. Nothing happened. No laws were broken. It's nice to see you actually in person, Tom, as opposed to, I think it's the second time in about a year and a half I've actually seen you in the flesh. And you look pretty much the same, to be honest with you.
I think I've aged a bit, actually. I look a lot younger. More than a year and a half's worth of aging has happened in the last year and a half, I feel, anyway.
Yeah,
it might just be the hair and beard, both growing wildly.
I guess I see you every week on Zoom, so I probably don't notice, and I'm probably not paying much attention anyway. So, I'm sorry about your milk situation. I mean, that does sound really distressing. I mean, people are going to think I'm being sarcastic, but I'm really not. We ran out of milk this week, and I absolutely hate that. I really hate it, because I like to have a snack of cereal most evenings. Oh, you like that as well, Daniel? Oh, it's such a good thing. It's such a good thing.
Jamie, I find this quite outrageous, because you've revealed to me once that you're a double cereal, aren't you? You have two different types of cereal in your bowl.
Sometimes more. Sometimes three, even four.
And I just find this, to be honest, I like the purity of a single type of cereal in the bowl.
You're a fascist. You're a cereal.
is a cereal Calvinist.
I will have my bowl of whatever it is, crunchy nut cornflakes or Frosties.
Like Alvin.
Oh yeah.
Anything with sugar in it, real sugar. I avoid it.
This could be a total a podcast in itself, really, discussing this. At the moment, I have this this raisin and almond granola topped with Shreddies, and then I put yogurt on top of it, mostly natural yogurt, and then I put honey on the top of that, and that is really nice.
There's a lot going on in that, Jamie. I mean, how could you appreciate any of the individual things? There's too much of a mix, really. I don't know. You know, each to his own, I guess. I would find that quite a distressing meal to begin my day with, or indeed end.
There's nothing distressing about complementary difference, Tom.
I think one could praise it for its diversity.
Exactly, yeah. Cereal diversity is what I'm into. We should probably introduce Daniel. Daniel French, priest of the West Country, spectator columnist, man of the moment. How are you doing, Daniel?
Scoundrel. Was it scoundrel?
Fight St. Patrick's Day. This was brilliant. I have to say, I am also a cereal holic.
Great.
I'm probably the most sugary, the better, and would go for the sort of 11 o'clock in the night, complete melange of anything I can find cereal-wise. And up to about a couple months ago, I began to kind of wonder, you know, am I beginning to encroach at 52 towards diabetes? And maybe I should take a break from this. And I have taken a break from this. Although on St. Patrick's Day, I decided to treat myself to a pot noodle and a sort of rice, chocolate Rice Krispie thing. So here I am on Irreverent having my first bit of sugar for 2 months. So I'm probably going to be completely all over the place.
You're going to be high as a kite.
I am going to be as high as a kite, yeah. But I have to say, the cereal, I now kind of go for the blandest cereal with strawberries, which is okay. But
previous to that, Daniel, what would you have, because I mean, I'll just be honest about this. I just eat sugary children cereal sometimes.
Oh, like, yeah, that's fantastic. Cereal. Cocoa Pops.
That's all I eat, Jimmy.
Cocoa Pops,
Cocoa Pops are fine. They're really, except for the Kellogg's ones, because they've cut the sugar in them.
Yeah,
so I avoid those now and go for the sort of Tesco's own, because as far as I can tell, they keep the sugar levels up.
Oh,
I'm not a fan of the sugar tax. I think it's outrageous, because they made all my drinks and all the snacks are like more expensive.
I noticed that after I went for a couple of years without having Cocoa Pops, and then I had them again. I thought, what's going on here? This is just not the same. You know, I'm not getting the same buzz from this anymore.
But what you have to do then is, the elixir of the gods is it's either, I find, it's either a flake or chocolate buttons. You put them on top of the Cocoa Pops, a sprinkling of Alpen to make it, you know, to kind of give it the respectability of hell. and then a whole load of UHT foamy cream, you know, whipped on it as well.
Wow.
And I'm ready for bed.
UHT, oh my goodness.
You go to bed on that much sugar, blimey.
Yeah. Weird dreams.
I thought I was into cereal, Daniel, but I think I've been upstaged by you on this podcast.
So I've been 2 months cold turkey. And
yeah, you're going to go back to it at some point.
I don't know. I'm hoping to get my pension, really. So I'm going to get one or two things. Maybe I should just, you know.
Yeah, just moderate.
Relax on a bit, you know.
Yeah.
And a love for red meat and chocolate. Yeah.
Well, nobody can criticise your taste, Daniel, although probably some people will try to, but maybe not many people listening to this podcast. Some good news. We've gone 7 places up in the Christianity charts for Great Britain. We're now at number 47. We're right next to the Profile interview, the Christian Premier Radio show. And we're 5 places above Joel Osteen. Can you believe that? He's got the biggest church in the world, doesn't he? Or you know, he's got a massive church, and yet our podcast is more popular than his. Take that, Joel Osteen. Number one is The Bible in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz, who looks like he's a Roman Catholic. So he's got the might of the Vatican behind his podcast. Yeah. But we're coming for you, Father Mike. You just wait. We'll be up there at number one.
He'll have a whole load of monks in some cellar with screens, kind of working on sort of Google search engines.
He's got a load of monks with bots on Twitter.
Yeah.
That image just made me laugh. Right. Okay. Well, we did actually once go up to number 3 for a day, which is quite remarkable, really.
So I just dropped water all over myself.
All right.
This is the sugar. It's all going to pot down in Devon.
I'm going to get a towel. Bear with me a second.
Next thing we know, there's going to be shelves and books everywhere. I'm very good, Jamie, on the whole.
You're answering a question from 10 minutes ago.
Well, I don't know whether we're keeping on going or whether we're stopping. It's always very, you know, ambiguous.
What I was going to do is, I've been meaning to read, we've had a few pieces of creative writing come into us, and I wanted to read at least one of them. I've been meaning to read them out for ages. So what I was going to do is ask you which one you want as a kind of, you know, sort of interesting feature. So we've got we've got a few things. We've got Rosemary's got 2 entries. She's written a poem called Leaving the Church in the Lurch. She's rewritten the first chapter of Genesis and called it the first book of Sage called Paralysis. We've got Christine's Scientist Creed, and we've also got the Duncan's COVID Commandments. Which one of those do you want to hear?
I think the Scientist Creed sounds quite interesting.
Okay, yeah. Daniel's still clearing up his...
After nearly baptising the Mac.
Yeah, right. So we're going to have the Scientist Creed by Christine Hampton here, Daniel. Just so you know, I've just given Tom the choice of which piece of creative writing he wants to hear. And he's gone for the Scientist Creed, which is just loading up on my computer now. All right, here we go. So, the Scientist Creed. I believe in Sage, the science almighty, creator of models and vaccines. This scans quite well, actually. And in Matt Hancock, his only disciple, Artur Mental, who was conceived by the Holy Johnson, born of the public health officials, suffered under the COVID recovery group, was questioned, ridiculed on Twitter, and was discredited. He descended into a red room. On the I've lost count of how many days, he rose again from the maelstrom. He ascended into Imperial College and is seated at the right hand of Sage, the Science Almighty. From there, he will come to judge the living and the unvaccinated. I believe in the Holy Johnson, the holy model creators, the communion of variants, the forgiveness of atrocities against thine people, the resurrection of the lockdown and COVID everlasting. Amen. It's quite good, I thought.
It's not bad. I think in some dialects, a Holy Johnson would be quite rude. But other than that...
dear, oh dear, I can't believe you did that.
Have you seen they've got a new government briefing room? It was £2.3 million. When you look at it, you think, where did the money go? Because it just looks like a school assembly room with a podium and a couple of screens and a Union Jack. I mean, yeah. And the chairs even look...
They have like four Union Jacks up there and loads of people wringing their hands about this, saying, oh, there's too many Union Jacks. Oh, it's too nationalistic. Is that the same room? I just thought, that's remarkable, isn't it? How much money? £2 million.
£2.3 million.
I mean, it's amazing how good governments are at overspending, really, and how little people seem to care about this. I mean, you know, the civil service seems to be capable of spending vast amounts of money on just about nothing on a regular basis. I mean, it happens over and over again, doesn't it? People just shrug now. Oh, £2.5 million. Oh, well, on a roof. Yeah, good. That's all right. At least it wasn't £2.5 billion, I guess. That's 2 days of lockdown, by the way, for our listeners. And, you know,
£2 million.
So it's about £1 billion a day, I think.
£1 million. I could probably just never work again. Do you know?
£2.5 million.
Yeah, probably.
But certainly, yeah. I mean, you might not... It depends how quickly Sunak inflates the pound into worthlessness, doesn't it? But it'll give you a couple of years at least.
Yeah, it depends how much money I spend on Twitter bots to podcast coverage.
Yeah, those monks.
Right, I want to read out Rosemary's
poem. Found a few monasteries.
Yeah. just to increase our podcast audience with monkish Twitter bots. I'm going to read Rosemary's poem because she's put a lot of effort into this. Okay, so this is called Leaving the Church in the Lurch. Okay, George, turn on the computer. It's here in the room because it's time for the virtual service on Zoom. The church building is locked and that is no mistake. After 800 years, it was time for a break. It's very unlikely to open again, which is great because the upkeep was always a pain. And then Zoom, so much better. As the vicar has said, there's no need to dress up, even get out of bed. No need for a handshake. Oh, very good, Daniel. No need for a handshake. Our neighbour to greet. We'll like him on Facebook and uptick his tweet. No need to say prayers. It was never a laugh. We'll let the church wardens pray on our behalf. No need to endure while our little choir sings the music recorded on a CD from King's. If the sermon is boring, as we cannot be seen, we can minimise Zoom and pull up a new screen. No going up to the altar. No need to receive. No need to kneel humbly. No need to believe. And then a coda. Do not hope for salvation. You won't get the nod. If you can't be bothered, then why should your God? There we are, from Rosemary. It's quite a challenging coda there at the end of that pericope. So thank you very much.
Daniel, did you briefly change your background to that of this £2.5 million meeting hall by any chance?
Oh, what do you think?
I think
it should be the new irreverent.
The chairs look really cheap.
We treat ourselves once we get up to sort of like 10.
Yeah. I mean, the idea that those are the notice boards that they use in schools, isn't it? To sort of to pin back of churches as well, like pin Mothers Union notices on those notice boards. So yeah, I'm glad they found a few. Obviously, because the churches were closed, they weren't using them, so they must have scabbed them from there.
When I use those. In church, we've got one of those in church. I usually fall over it because I push too hard. You know? I mean, you'd think that, you know, for £2.3 million, you get something more like Dr. Charles Xavier's sort of mental room, you know, with
the big one, yeah, from X-Men,
you'd want something a bit more like that, wouldn't you, really, or at least Dr. Evil's lair, you know.
Well, it'd be good to have a sort of visual representation of the sort of totalitarian state that we've fallen into when they're giving it, you know, maybe 30 story tall concrete block or something
Grand Moff Tarkin's office in the desk.
Are those chairs? I mean, I cannot believe how cheap those chairs look, because you know you can get some really nice folding chairs, really high quality, which can go on one of those trolleys, and you can move them around really easily. Those just look tacky and cheap. I'm starting to question this 2 million. I wonder where did this money really go?
Where does the money? It's a bit like I watched Independence Day the other day because my wife hadn't ever seen it or claimed never to have seen it, and which is a weird thing to. I mean, I'm not a film buff, but not to have seen Independence Day. Jamie's looking slightly disgusted.
I like Independence Day.
You don't like it?
No, I do like it. One of my wife's favourite films.
It's a great film. I really enjoyed it. And there's a really quite funny moment where David's father...
David!
David! Accosts the president and the secretary of state about, do you really think it costs £1 million to change a dustbin? Yeah, when the question is, how do they fund Area 51? And basically, I mean, here we are. Do you really think it costs £2.5 million to put up a school assembly room in the corner of Downing Street? No.
He probably doesn't say it costs £1 million to fund a dustbin. He would say $1 million to fund a... Do you have an American listenership as well, who we have to respect? You know, we've actually gone up in the charts in Sweden as well. We're up in the charts in Sweden. There are only a handful of listeners in Sweden, so maybe there aren't many people who listen to Christian podcasts.
Well, they're laughing, I suppose, having not had a lockdown.
Yeah,
they need some comedy moment.
Are they still not locked down? That's good, because their government was sort of trying to do its best to find the powers to do it.
They can't.
And there's a wonderful moment, wasn't there? Because the government published recommendations to wear masks on public transport against the wishes of Tegnell, the chief scientist for the health service. And there was a picture of him on a bus shortly after with his team, none of them wearing masks. CEBM recently published a sort of age standardized mortality rates for Europe, didn't they? And Sweden bang in the middle there with 1.5% excess deaths over the prevailing few years. We're at about 15%. It's a good thing that Sweden locked down, and real shame we did. Oh wait, hang on. As our listeners will know, this really exposes that lie that if we hadn't locked down, there'd have been apocalyptic problems. We're not that different.
You're quite right.
They're a bit odd. I'll give you that. And maybe eating rotted sardines or mackerel or whatever it is they their famous kind of rotted fish festival. That's so potent they have to open it underwater. You not come across this?
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
There's a famous Scandinavian dish which is effectively rotted fish. They bury fish in sea.
I just want to say to all our Swedish listeners, I'm really sorry about this. I don't know what the heck Tom is talking about.
To our British listeners, they don't do this at home.
And they eat it, and it smells so bad that they have to open the can underwater. It might be Norwegian, actually, but they're... who knows? Scandinavia. Maybe that's why they are.
We should probably talk about some current affairs thing, as this is meant to be a current affairs podcast. Yeah.
Well, that was current affairs, wasn't it? I mean, they still eat them, as far as I'm aware.
So I'll say goodbye to the government.
It's up to you, Daniel. It gives you a sort of air of back in your office now. So what do we want to talk about first? We could talk about the... church leaders meeting with the government. We could talk a bit about what's been going on with vaccination, or we could talk about the stuff with the tragic murder of Sarah Everard and the fallout. Where should we go first?
Well, let's go with the church leaders, because I think it's very irritating, isn't it, that you know, and one of the things that I think lockdown skeptics have often said is, you know, once a government takes powers onto itself, it takes an awful lot for them to give them up.
Yeah.
And of course, everyone reassures us, no, this is an emergency, they'll be gone.
They'll give them back. It'll be fine. Yeah.
They're claiming that all restrictions are going to go by the 21st, but actually we might keep churches restricted in a variety of ways.
Yeah.
For as long as we like, really.
So let's say what this is. So this is from, somebody sent me this, johnstevens.com. Now, John Stevens, I think, is some kind of person in the FIEC, which is Federation of Independent Evangelical Churches, I think it is. So he's some kind of leader or overseer in that. And this was posted on the 10th of March, and it's a record, or it's a putative record of a meeting he had with the Minister of Faith and Officials. I don't know if that doesn't seem right, but anyway, so basically a meeting with the government, and it basically talks about how the roadmap out of lockdown is going to affect churches. And the thing which I think is really disturbing is what is this bit here, where it says, although the roadmap provides for a gradual removal of restrictions on mixing in groups, with all social restrictions intended to be removed on June 21st, this does not mean that all social distancing requirements will be removed. At present, the 2 meter social distancing guidance and requirement to wear masks in church will remain in place after June 21, which is meant to be the end of this whole thing. And that's certainly the impression that they gave when they were putting out this roadmap, wasn't it? That this would basically be over by June 21st. And now they're saying that in churches, there will still be social distancing and mask wearing after June 21st.
Well, I'm not surprised. Can you imagine if you were a fly on the wall from the church party at that meeting, how much pushback was given?
How much?
I guess. I bet you there was a sort of, well, okay, that's fine.
Well, yeah, I mean,
we can go with that if you say so.
According to this article, I mean, you know, the point was made of the difficulty of planning summer events such as festivals, where decisions need to be made as the capacity of venues and so on. No assurance could be provided that social distancing will be reduced/removed, so it would be unwise to plan on this basis until there is clarification nearer the time. Whether these restrictions can be removed will depend upon the progress of infection rates and whether new variants of the virus emerge that require the measures to stay in place. The approach is deliberately cautious, so no commitment can be made on the removal, etc., etc., etc.
So I guess on one hand, Jamie, that it might just be sort of civil servant governmentees that they're not prepared to make any firm commitments because in the end the buck doesn't stop with them. We've got, you know, Boris Johnson or Matt Hancock or Michael Gove might suddenly turn around and put a wobbly and push everything back. And, you know, that's quite believable, isn't it? Because they've already said that they might do that. And that might just be what's going on here. But on the other hand, you can easily believe that they might, at the very least, sort of keep the recommendations in place just in case. And that's not really, I mean, I could see that happening. And the problem with that is that insurance and sort of various other, you know, status centralized and authoritarian bodies, once a recommendation's in place, it's, you know, for example, the diocese will still be pressuring churches to abide by them,
yeah.
With potential, I know at least one diocese at the beginning of this crisis, you know, potential safeguarding issues if you don't abide by recommendations was made. I think that was Chelmsford, wasn't it? Right at the beginning, which was quite outrageous. So that's a problem, really. It's a serious problem. And I rather hope all our listeners write to their MPs and say, look, actually, can you just confirm that this won't happen? Because it's outrageous that the church presumes to, the state presumes to interfere in the work of the church, really. It's beyond its remit.
Yeah. And it does seem strange to me because nightclubs are going to open, right? So how can nightclubs be open where presumably you can't have social distancing? But the church would have to have social distancing. That doesn't really make any sense to me, unless they're not planning on opening nightclubs and this is a kind of, you know, this is just them showing their hand slightly in a meeting, which they, you know, they don't expect to be publicized or, yeah, it's very, I don't know, it's very odd, isn't it? Just the blasé, you know, just the blasé way this is presented, as though, oh yeah, of course social distancing is still going to be in place in church. Well, hang on. We thought it wasn't. We've been planning upon the basis that it's going to be over by G20. We were talking about having a Thanksgiving mass, you know, for the end of all of this. I mean, it wasn't my idea. I do feel quite skeptical about, well, certainly now, whether this is going to end. But yeah, I don't know. What's your view, Daniel?
Well, I think on the back of this has also been the wedding confusion.
Yeah.
Come out in the last few days as well, which seems to indicate that wedding venues are not going to be able to open in the weeks before. So a lot of weddings are being pushed forward. Now, you can imagine that couples doing this, if they're going to have a wedding in church, are they still going to be expected to be masked up? You know, is there going to be singing?
Yeah.
Is there going to be nuptial masses with the common cup, et cetera, et cetera? I think they're saying 7,000 weddings at the moment are in the hold.
Wow. Amazing.
It impinges on all sorts of things, doesn't it? I'm just not surprised. I just have this niggling feeling in the back of my head that at that, or those meetings, one meeting or a series of meetings, that from our side, very little was given in terms of pushback on this. Because at the moment, we've felt it as clergy, haven't we? As lockdown skeptic clergy, that on the whole, the atmosphere in the C of E is to be as compliant as possible on this. Yeah. And
not just to be compliant, but actively to agitate for extra rules and to push and even, you know, going right back a year ago, to go beyond what the rule, the guidelines said. I don't know if anyone remembers that there was an exemption from the first lockdown for about a week for attending a privately going to say prayers in a church. Which was effectively taken out after about a week. This is not a public gathering. This is after the public services had been banned, but before the final legislation was put in place. And there's a short window where you were allowed out of your house. I believe it might have been when it was recommended rather than mandatory. And that was taken out the week after. And you can just, that's exactly the sort of thing where you'd expect the churches to maybe have gone, why has this happened? Why has this gone? And can you justify it, please? Because, you know, if one person owning the church or whatever, is that actually a problem? You know, isn't this a step too far? But they're not, you know, instead they literally banned their own ministers from going into the church. I mean, or actually it turned out they didn't ban, strongly recommended.
In that week, I remember, because it all happened very quickly, didn't it? The church house pumped out these downloadable posters which said, "We're still open. You know, come in, we're still open." About 3-4 days later, they then put out no clothes.
Yeah, I love this. I shared this with you guys earlier on our little group, didn't I? I'll do a little screen share here. The Church of England Twitter account. "It's been a year since we started worshipping online together, with more than 55 services, 382 contributors and 258 pieces of music. We've loved every minute. Revisit the best bits of our services at cv.io, etc., etc."
Revisit.
We've loved every minute of this lockdown.
They're going to be publishing this on a DVD with the deleted scenes, for goodness. I mean, it's extraordinary, isn't it?
It's absolutely crazy. Look, I'm sorry, but nobody's going to revisit the online Zoom services. It's not going to happen. I just think that, you know, we've loved every minute. I know what they're trying to say. They're trying to say, oh, you know, we've had a good time connecting on Zoom. Like, I've loved doing this podcast. But, you know, I'm not going to, when it gets to a year of this debacle, I'm not going to be celebrating it like it's some kind of anniversary. which, you know, we need to sort of, you know, like it's the birthday of the lockdown. Like we should all gather around and sing happy birthday to the lockdown. Like we're really glad it's happened. And the church is actually producing all these resources, isn't it? You were sharing some from your diocese annual, yes. You know, to try and sort of mark the anniversary of this lockdown. Like it's something to be, you know, I don't know, like something to be grateful for.
Honoured.
Yeah. What were the resources you shared with us? I'm just trying to remember.
It was actually a national.
Oh, was it?
National. It was a link to a national platform with resources.
I think, isn't Boris Johnson
calling for bizarre prayers. And again, no kind of critical sense of. The whole thing is acquiescent, you know, in terms of. We've had this year. We're not going to morally comment on it. We're not going to repent of it. We're going to, you know, clearly and I suppose rightly account for loss.
Yeah.
But really what they're marking is not the, I mean, the disease was already happening a month before in the UK. So why not do it from the first COVID death rather than from Boris Johnson's announcement?
Yeah, Boris.
So that's some sacred feast day, for goodness sake.
Yeah, it's Boris.
This is, I mean, for me, this is the day when we went off the rails. Trashed people's mental health.
We left behind our pre-pandemic planning and went and forged into a completely untested, untried.
Well, apart from the Chinese Communist Party, in Italy,
It's not a day I'm going to be marking with anything other than despair, I think, and not
certainly not something to celebrate. Like it's, you know, I think it's inappropriate, to be honest with you. And also, you know, it, I think what it does is it shows this kind of perverse delight that certain sectors of society, as we were talking about last week, you know, almost exclusively middle class sectors of society are taking in this thing like it's anything less than an absolute tragedy, regardless of what position you take on COVID, whether you think it was the right thing to do the lockdown or not. It's a disaster. The whole thing is a disaster. We've trashed the economy. If you believe in the narrative, then 130,000 people have died of COVID. And regardless of what you think about the narrative, I think it's, you know, we should all be willing to accept the massive collateral damage that the lockdown has had on people. So it's totally inappropriate. It's just totally inappropriate. I honestly don't know what they're thinking. But there we go. Boy, should we talk about this the vaccine debacle that's been going on? I intentionally tried to steer away from vaccines last week because the week before we majored on vaccines for such a long period of time. But basically, I think what's started to happen is that a number of countries in Europe have started to or have withdrawn the AstraZeneca vaccine because of the various instances of people developing blood clots and in some cases even dying after having it for this reason. And I had a tweet yesterday, which I'm just looking at now, which show that the following countries have withdrawn this jab. So Germany, Ireland, Austria, Netherlands, Switzerland, Latvia, Italy, Lithuania, Estonia, Iceland, South Africa, Thailand, Congo, Bulgaria, Iran, Denmark, Norway, Luxembourg, and France. So it seems to be quite a serious problem. Now, the press in our country, such as the BBC, not that I read the BBC, but my wife told me this, have been saying that this is actually fine. And Keir Starmer has said it's fine as well. So that's reassuring. I'm not sure why these governments have withdrawn this vaccine if everything's absolutely fine. But yeah, it's kind of confusing, really. What's your take on it, chaps?
I'm not able really to comment on whether it is or isn't fine. I am sceptical of the claims being made by a lot of people that, you know, when someone says the vaccine is absolutely safe, we know that the vaccine is safe. Well, actually, there's a certain amount that we don't know about the vaccine, not least because it's a truth that they haven't completed all of the normal set of trials that they would do in order normally to have been permitted to be used on humans on a wide scale. That's simply true, and it's also obviously true that they're under an emergency use authorization. They're not normally authorized. So to say they're completely safe is bold. I mean, I hope they are.
It's worse than bold, though, isn't it? It's just not.
It's untrue. It's untrue.
You don't know. When you say something is safe, what you're saying is, I know that X is safe, and that statement is false because we don't know it anyway. So I didn't want to interrupt.
No, I agree with you in as much as you know. Those caveats need to be there, don't they? But they're obviously not there because people don't want to water down their message that this is safe, so go and have it. Which is, it's a problem, a real problem, especially if you're going to coerce people. I saw something about this in terms of an American pro-vaccine Twitter account that basically said, you know, we shouldn't be hiding the fact that this is an emergency authorization, and that you know, really it has to be up to you whether you take it or not. We don't know that this is entirely safe. We can't. It's impossible to. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether this is a problem. You know, I do know that sort of when people say things like, Daily Mail had an article saying, well, the vaccines are 10,000 times safer than COVID. Yeah, but actually, specific risk changes, doesn't it? So when you give it to an 18-year-old, you might find there are similar risks, actually, when it boils down to it. As I said last time, if you're over 70, there's much more obvious rationale for taking it than if you're a sort of 30-year-old. I still feel that it should be uncoerced and entirely up to each person whether they take the vaccine or not. And I don't feel that that's being pushed, being given enough space either in the press or by the government. And you know, every day we hear, I think today's was P&O Cruises who are going to not allow you on unless you are vaccinated, which I think, I'm not sure it would stand up in court, to be honest, because I think there are valid religious exemptions to vaccines normally, and there are certainly medical exemptions to vaccines. So you wouldn't be given either of these vaccines, for example, if you were had severe allergies, because they do lead to severe side effects to people who you can get allergic reactions. So I rather hope the government at some point will tell people they shouldn't be doing this. But on the contrary, I see that Michael Gove has actually launched a consultation into vaccine passports. So again, if you're listening, go fill that in. Tell the government you don't like the idea in as stronger terms as possible, I think. That's my opinion. But,
yeah. Daniel, any comments?
Oh, you know, Michael Gove in many ways is a natural technocrat, isn't he? I have very mixed feelings about his time as education secretary and his particular draconian exercising of school absenteeism.
Yeah, it's ironic, isn't it?
the problem, well, yes, exactly. The problem was, really, the real problem is secondary school truancy. Of kids who are dropping out because they feel that the system is offering them nothing. Punishing everybody by saying that families, you know, can't take their children away who are in primary school for a week in France, that has no educational benefit. In comparison to, say, let's say in June, when they'll be sat in school probably largely watching videos and playing games, it is just facile. Yeah, and it's that kind of mindset, isn't it? If you see that projected, that kind of bulldozer technocratic mindset imposed at a larger scale, you can see that this is just going to cause a whole series of upsets and ethical issues. And you know, as Tom's picking up, the word safety can be used in a propagandist sense.
Yeah.
And so that it's not being portrayed obviously every medicine has a side effect or has a danger. There is a safety element. You know, it might be minuscule, it might be 0.1 of a population who receive it. But I think it would be, I would have a lot more respect. And I suspect in, you know, there are countries in America where there's quite a sizable portion of the population do not are saying that they're not going to receive the vaccine. You know, if government was a bit more upfront and said there is a risk, and the risk is approximately, you know, 1 in 10,000.
Yeah.
Then at least you could say, well, that's being honest, but saying there's no risk at all, it's totally safe. You know, it is facetious in my view. You know. And, and I'm someone who took the whole set of antibiotics to miracle drugs, which I am extremely allergic to you know, on an anaphylactic level. So, you know, kind of don't tell me that. I was used as a BMA study for an allergy to this set of antibiotics. So, yeah, this supposed wonder drug. You know, we've all seen wonder drugs, haven't we? Given the hard sell over periods of the 20th century, from the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, there was a particular vaccine combo that made a lot of people ill. Flynnmite, you know, you could, there's a whole range of ones where this was oversold. Tell me the risk. Yeah, at least I know where I stand. I think it's much more than I know we're having an honest conversation and I can. Yeah.
I think the problem here is, Daniel, they just don't know what the risk is. That's a big part of the problem. They don't know what the risk is because they haven't observed the long-term effects of the vaccines. And it's looking increasingly like even the short and medium term effects of the vaccines are quite unknown. So I was talking to Lorna about this earlier because, you know, neither of us really know what's going on. All we've got access to is the internet like everyone else. And we're not scientists or we're not medical professionals. So how can you tell what's going on? I think it's quite interesting that the people in our country who support the COVID catastrophe narrative are trying to now. This is really ironic, I think, because what they're doing is they're saying, well, the reason that these countries have withdrawn the AstraZeneca vaccine is their political reasons, right? So this narrative has become politicized in those countries. You know, it's to do with the EU or whatever. And you're thinking, hang on a second, it's politicized in those countries. You know, can you not see what you're missing there? This whole thing is politicized, the whole thing, including in our country. So that cuts both ways. You know, you can't say that the narrative is politicized in France or Ireland or Germany, but it's not politicized here. Like vaccines have no political significance at all here, and we're just neutrally following the science. Whereas presumably the technocrats and the scientists and the doctors in those countries, they're just all in the thrall of their governments, and they hate the EU. They hate Britain for leaving the EU so much that they're going to withdraw a vaccine that they've got this incredible amount of political capital in. It's
a very contorted Brexit, an attempt to resurrect the Brexit narrative. I saw someone on Twitter this morning say, well, now looking at what's happened in Europe, I wished I hadn't voted Remain. And various people were passing this around, this noted individual that said this.
It's ironic, really, because whatever way round, I mean, that's one of the things that we've always said. I'm a Brexiteer, passionate one at times. And one of the things I always thought about the EU was that it's basically monolithic and inflexible bureaucracy was always going to be its downfall. But I kind of agree with you, Jamie. There are a lot of people who are very, very wounded in the EU's bureaucracy about Brexit, and I could almost believe that some of them were stupid enough to to reject a vaccine simply because it's British and successful. I could believe it because, you know, it's a similar level of stupidity to, you know, not getting a trade deal with England, with the UK when that damages both sides enormously. You know, similar levels, you know, when both sides clearly want and need to trade, but oh no, we're not going to do it because we're basically irritated at you.
Yeah, so I might point out, Tom, this is germane to the point that several of these countries are not even in the EU who have withdrawn this.
Well, yeah, true.
Some of them aren't even in Europe.
Okay, like Iran, you mentioned.
Thailand. Iran. Do they hate Brexit as well?
Well, I guess possibly. Who knows?
Yeah,
no, it makes, and there's a couple of interesting articles. I think there's one in Spiked about how this was a misapplication of the precautionary principle, which again is very ironic from lockdown supporters because the whole lockdown is a miss. Well, I mean, you know, you can't really complain about the precautionary principle when it's basically guided our last 12 months by following it rigidly. I mean, it's a stupid principle because you can't follow it. It doesn't really work in real life.
So Tom, sorry, can I just ask about that then? So what are they saying, that it's okay for us to apply the precautionary principle with all the non-pharmaceutical interventions, but when it comes to vaccines, we're not applying the precautionary principle?
Yeah, we shouldn't. It's just, you know, Europe of applying it too hard and too strong.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we're absolutely not applying any kind of precautionary principle when it comes to the vaccines. I think we're in the opposite end of the spectrum. We've gone hard on these non-pharmaceutical interventions in support of this precautionary principle, but there's no precaution at all when it comes. Well, there is some, but not as much as there would normally be with something like this, particularly if it's going to be given to, I don't know what number, we were at 20 million last week, we're probably at something like 30 million this week. It's remarkable. I mean, surely with something like this, when you're vaccinating tens of millions around the world, hundreds of millions of people, you should be applying a precautionary principle in case something's wrong with it.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, it's just quite ironic as an attack on Europe to say, oh well, they, you know, this is a misapplication of the precautionary principle, which is something we've been saying for a long time. I mean, I personally, Charlie, I'm really bad with names when I'm tired. I just called you Charlie.
Where has that come from?
Do you know what, Jamie? I've spent with our bubble a lot of time with loads of children everywhere because we're bubbled with someone who has children and. They're just names all over the place, Jamie. I forgot the name of my son, my wife, my friends.
Is one of them called Charlie, though?
There isn't an Uncle Charlie. No, I've got a friend called Charlie. Must have been. Anyway.
Must be an imaginary friend.
Maybe, who knows? I watched Forrest Gump the other day for the first time.
94.
One of the fun.
Thomas Marcus.
Very good. I enjoyed it. It's a wonderful film, and it's sort of tragedy and comedy go hand in hand throughout. Yeah. And there's this wonderful moment where he says about Vietnam, we went on lots of long walks in the jungle looking for someone called Charlie.
What were you saying?
Well, I don't know, Jamie. I've lost it.
Okay, good.
Sleep deprivation. I think I was saying precautionary principle has been misapplied. And then I think in terms of the MPIs, to then complain that it's been misapplied for, overly applied for the vaccines by the same people, I think is a bit, it's a bit rich, really.
There was an extraordinary piece on the BBC website yesterday which said, I was going to text it to you, but forgot to do so. The EU divided over AstraZeneca,
right?
And when you actually look at the figures, it's a very strange division. It's not a 50-50 division, because there's a map in another website which, you know, color codes it all and shows that the majority have suspended use.
Wow.
Whereas the dissenting voices, or those who've done nothing or carrying on, I think like Poland, it's a minority voice. So how could the Beeb say, you know, there's a great division now in the EU, but no, they're pretty united.
Yeah, they're pretty unanimous.
Caution.
Yeah. It's interesting. All of this is interesting. I'd just like to say, if Matthew from South Africa is listening to this podcast, do send us an email to tell us what's going on. If you know any more about this, because I'd like to hear from people who actually live in these countries to hear their perspectives. I mean, part of the problem is it's hard to get beyond the British press, isn't it? Even on Twitter and stuff like that.
Quite extraordinary. I mean, yeah. I put in two. I've got two browsers on my computer. On one browser, I had news outside the UK, and the other various providers here. And I was quite shocked, actually. And it's not that we're necessarily telling untruths; we're just being coy with the picture. And that's a form of manipulation.
Yeah, absolutely. We got a really good email from a friend of the show, James, who wrote a really good article, which I shared with you guys on the documents, on his blog, reflectivepreacher.org. And he called it "Why I'm Not Having the Vaccine." And I thought this was a really good article because he lays out the issues very clearly. He's a 70-year-old man. And he says, as far as he's aware, he has no health issues, doesn't take medications, very fit, etc. And so I'll just read some of these out. Some of the issues that have affected his decision. Because of his health, he's not scared of getting COVID, despite our media and government doing their very best to scare me as much as they can with every single announcement and advert. Approximately 130,000 people have died with COVID. Nobody knows how many have died of it. The massive majority of those who've died are over 75 with at least two serious health problems. If our population is 67 million, then the risk of dying with it is well below 0.2%. I therefore do not consider that statistically I need the vaccine. And he says others most certainly do and should be encouraged to have it. I'm inherently uncomfortable with the fact that every vaccine producer, so far as I'm aware, has refused to supply unless they're granted immunity from prosecution for any sickness or death caused by their vaccine. Just skip over the next bit. In view of this general indemnity, why would governments not step in and assume this responsibility if they're so certain that the vaccine won't produce long-term effects? Currently, the virus is in retreat on a global basis. The general view is that numbers infected will continue to fall in the UK. Why would I want to have a vaccine when it's least needed? I'm inherently uncomfortable about taking a vaccine that's being very strongly promoted by a group of government advisors, some of whom are known to have huge investments in some vaccine companies, such as I think Patrick Vallance has something like, was it £600,000 invested in GSK, for example? What happened to conflict of interest rules? I'm inherently uncomfortable about the failure to report or discuss data in some countries that might be indicating potential risks with vaccines. There's been a more or less total press clampdown on even discussing what the level of risk may be. It's like what we were just saying. There's a complete absence of debate on this point. What has happened to good old what has happened to good old fashioned investigative journalism? I'm inherently uncomfortable about the fact that there's so much debate about vaccine passports, even ones that may prevent people from visiting shops, cinemas, sporting events, etc. Why would I trust those who seem to be actively considering coercing people rather than educating and informing them? I admit that my own levels of trust in our authorities has fallen markedly since last March. We've been subjected to one algorithmic forecast after another that have been proved to be incorrect to a factor of several 100%. The people who are promoting the adoption of the vaccines are the very same people whose advice until now has at best been less than totally reliable. And he goes on several other really good points. He makes some theological points as well. I'm not afraid of death, and I worry about the underlying current in the debate, that this is about the long overdue abolition of death. I've spent my entire life trying to support those who have no power and no voice and trying to encourage them when the world has been united against them. I'm not afraid of being on the wrong side of a debate. I rather feel that it's almost our duty as Christians to show the world a different way. Some of my closest friends would actually say that this is what defines me as a person more than anything else. And I've often been found to be in the right in the longer run. As someone who's trained as a Christian minister, I believe that we owe our flocks a demonstration that we trust in the Lord for our salvation rather than trusting in something created by mankind, however clear it might be.
I think there's a lot of good points there. And he puts out very clearly, and it's good to hear other ministers sort of stepping up. I think I could add another good one, if I may, which is worth considering, which is that in effect, when you think about what's happening in this country, we are being told that unless the vaccine is successful, we will stay under restrictions for as long as is necessary. We end up in a world where our freedoms are entirely predicated upon enough people taking up a medical procedure. Do we really want to live in that society? I mean, it doesn't even matter if it's effective or not. Do we really want to live in a society where our freedoms are not inherent God-given freedoms, as I always assumed they were, that you were born with, but rather they're freedoms that are entirely subject to other people's taking up at this moment, and experimental, because it is, vaccination treatment. And that's, if you think about it, is that really the world you want to live in? It's very Brave New World.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I worry, but this is what riles me about this marking the 1 year since the lockdown announcement. Because it struck me then, I mean, I think even Neil Ferguson said that, you know, that what he never dreamt that what they were doing in China could be transferred to over here, that the British would be compliant with this. And yet here we are, we've decided that the democracy, liberal democracy, is the gift of the state rather than the gift of God, and we've done so with enormous compliance and passivity. And for me, that's a day of incredible mourning. What we lost on that day was our God-given rights.
I agree.
It became state-given rights.
Yeah,
And can you imagine a power, a state, now having that, is ever going to relinquish that fully?
But, I mean, it can't, because, I mean, in a sense, as Lord Sumption pointed out in his magisterial interview on Unheard, that once a convention has been broken, that convention no longer exists. And our rights in this country were simply protected by convention, which is effectively the idea that such a thing can't be done because it'd be unthinkable, and now suddenly it's thinkable. What's the next thing that's under the same sort of utilitarian ethics that has driven this whole thing? What's the next thing that becomes thinkable that was once unthinkable? You know, what's the next thing we take from China?
Yeah.
Exactly. Of the Muslim population in China. I mean, you know,
one child policy.
Social credit.
Yeah.
At
the moment it can be demonstrated to, on a utilitarian calculation, save more lives than the other, than a sort of liberal democracy, and the moment presumably enough of our politicians are enamoured of it, is the moment they can just say, well, let's do it. Because that's what utilitarian eventually works towards. It's why, for example, generally speaking, we rejected that over our history. And as I wrote to our MP, my MP quite recently, and just said, you know, those countries which don't have a tradition of liberal democracy can now look at us and decide, really, even if we want, because what I think actually liberal democracy is an inherent good in itself, and I think freedom is an inherent good. The freedom to make choices, the freedom to have a social life, all these things that I think, you know, they are good things. Those countries that don't have them always justify it, of course, by danger. You know, Mugabe sits there and says, well, when he was alive, you know, I do this because, you know, I protect my people. I need all these things to be in place. Stalin said the same. Hitler said the same. This is the only way you will be safe. Rank utilitarianism has never taken our sort of culture, our humanity to good places. It's because rank utilitarianism says that if you see someone drowning, you see five people drowning in a pond, you should push someone in to help them climb out, you know, because you save four lives. But it's obviously morally evil.
Yeah, applied in that way, it has no conception of individual rights. I mean, there are more sophisticated forms of utilitarianism, but the way it tends to get applied in situations like this politically is very crude. You know, it's very, very crass. You know, well, you know, we can save 10,000 lives if we do X, Y, and Z, but, you know, X, Y, and Z might result in, you know, a smaller amount of damage, but that damage is never quantifiable. And of course, the problem in this situation is that that damage includes the confiscation of our rights and the transformation of our liberal democracy into an authoritarian police state, which is basically what's happened. Did either of you see the vaccine passport debate? Did you watch it?
Yeah.
I thought it was. I mean, it's hard to. I don't know what you thought, Daniel.
Okay. I wouldn't say I was fired up by it. I thought it was going to be a debate in Parliament, but it was in a committee room in Westminster Hall, which made it all a bit sanguine.
Because Parliament doesn't really meet at the moment, does it? I mean, it's a sort of sad shell of its old self, because they're all unable to fit in.
I thought it was interesting that the folks who were arguing for the motion were a lot of them were from Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Sort of a faith, which was the most faith-based part of the UK.
Yeah, and I don't know what to make of these debates, because there were a number of Conservative MPs who spoke strongly against it. Ben Bradley, is that his name? Ben Bradley, the sort of more sort of working class guy who's, well, he's not actually working class. He's more of a lad, isn't he? He's kind of a lad who's around 40. I don't think he's working class, actually. But Steve Baker, and a couple of others as well, spoke quite strongly against it. But it's hard to know how much clout this actually carries. And when the government minister came in, she basically said, well, this is preemptive because the report hasn't even, you know, they haven't even started writing the report yet. But it was interesting. One of the things I think, you know, and you can watch this, I'll try and put it on the show notes, you can watch the whole thing or read the transcript, but the amount of reasons not to do it are just overwhelming. You know, I mean, apart from the just basic political reasons that that's not the kind of country you want to live in, the actual unworkability of it. And one thing even the government minister herself pointed out is that we've just had this situation, which we'd like to talk about in a minute, where we've had this woman murdered, and now the whole thing about women's rights and protecting women, etc., has come into the public sphere again. Now, women have problems, apparently, getting jobs sometimes, because potential employers might think that they're pregnant, right? So they might even ask them, and they're not allowed to, but they might even ask them in an interview, are you pregnant, or are you thinking about getting pregnant? Now, pregnant women are advised not to take these vaccines at the moment. So if that continues and pregnant women don't take the vaccines, then whether or not you've had a vaccine as a woman could be an indicator that you're pregnant, and therefore could lead to you being discriminated against by employers.
It's just one thing.
It's just the implications of this are just, you can't get over it. It will lead to all sorts of discrimination, not just from people who refuse to have the vaccine.
And then there's religious discrimination.
Religious or health reasons or whatever. Sorry, Tom, go ahead.
And of course, there's obviously, and we've spoken about this before, but serious issues, I think, in how some of these vaccines are manufactured, and almost all of them are tested on using aborted fetal stem cell lines, which I think anyone certainly of a Christian persuasion should have serious issues with. I'm disappointed the church hasn't spoken out more about this, because I think even if you say, well, you know, they were aborted over 60 years ago in the almost 60 years ago in the 60s, there's a sort of ongoing serious issue, I think, of culturing and continuing to grow a tissue from a dead body that was killed, you know, unethically, because it was murdered in the womb, and is continued to be owned, cultured, grown, sold. I mean, what does that say? You know, there's an ongoing load of real sinful issues going on in that, which need to be spoken about, and they're not. In fact, various, I mean, some have. John Piper has been quite strong on this, I believe, but others have said no, it's fine. And you think, well,
it's terrible. I think I personally think it's awful the way that the Roman Church and our church has basically just has explicitly said that this is okay. You know, it's not okay, and it's certainly not unambiguously okay. This is an industry.
None of them, as far as I can tell, deal with the issue that actually it's not just a historical sin, but actually ongoing sin of continuing to culture them. Imagine that. I mean, what does that say about our treatment of bodies, our belief in the resurrection of the dead, our belief that that the human remains should be treated with reverence and fear, you know. What does it speak to? It's that is an ongoing problem. It's not just something that happened in the 60s. And there's ethical issues of that anyway. But you know, let's imagine that everyone turned around and said, we don't want these to be used in medical science anymore, and we're going to boycott medical science until they're stopped being used. The scientists would find alternative ways of growing of manufacturing these things, not tainted with this sort of sinful behaviour. Yeah. I think it's a problem.
I agree. I think it's a serious problem. So the debate, I don't think it really sort of didn't really provide any reassurance, I would say, because.
But I was going to say, sorry, I was also going to say that the idea of the government minister coming to say this preempts the report, there's an implication there that if the report comes out positive, the government will swing behind it. And I'm rather glad that hopefully there's been that this has been discussed to a degree already, and the parliament has shown to be generally not in favour of.
I think it's impossible. I just don't think they'll be able to do this. I think even though they've got their massive majority, I think this would be so controversial that even this increasingly authoritarian majority that the conservative government have couldn't get it through. It would be so outrageous.
They don't need to get it through Parliament, Jamie. They just need to allow it to happen.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, if P&O and Saga are in a sense doing it, if lots of airlines are going to do this, then we have it in effect. I mean, if Pimlico plumbers can have a no job, no jab, no jab, no job policy, and then I think there's a few others that Unilever are talking about doing this to all their employees. You know, if the army introduce it, you know, if you have to have the jab to get to become to remain in the NHS, you know, so on. I know you say that no government, that you can't imagine a Tory government voting this, but the level of fear that can, and certainly what I'm picking up, you know, on the ground, is that people are so apprehensive about things and have moved into this fear zone, which borders on hysteria.
But it breaks down that border, I think, Daniel. It jumps full.
Yeah, and allow anything. But, you know, I've had the conversation with people saying, you know, who'd happily have it that you shouldn't go into Tesco's if you don't have, you know, let alone Butlins or the Greek islands or.
It's absolutely insane, because at the moment it hasn't been tested for transmissibility, right? So we don't even know. It probably doesn't stop infection or transmissibility. So this whole thing is predicated on that assumption that it does these things, which we don't know if it does that or not. But just to speak to your point, Daniel, I agree that it's a serious issue, but it surely is a legal issue in that case. You know, if an employer tries to take away your job or try to not give you a job because you haven't had a medical treatment, that's an issue of discrimination. So they could presumably be sued reprimanded in some other way. So I guess that's a legal issue that needs to be clarified. I think that would be bad if that kind of thing actually starts happening, which with international travel it probably will to some extent, but what I think would be what I'm really most worried about, I suppose, is that you get in a situation where basically you have to carry around with you either some papers or an app on your smartphone, and that the police can basically stop you and ask you to produce this at any time to check that you haven't traveled, you know, 10 miles beyond the region where you live or something like that. So, you know, if I go to visit my mum in Essex, the police could just stop me at any point when I'm there and check my vaccination status. And if I'm not cleared to travel, then I could be fined or arrested or whatever. That's the dystopian nightmare, which I think we need to, you know, be very clear that we don't want that.
But I think it goes beyond that, Jamie. Like, I mean, I could easily see a situation where there's no official vaccine papers, but actually enough companies are saying, well, we're not going to let you in. That some smart app is created that basically becomes ubiquitous. If you want to go to a certain, if you want to go to the Slug and Lettuce, you need to have it, otherwise they won't let you in and serve you, whatever. You know, yes, I agree there are legal issues with that, but frankly, unless the government comes swinging out against it, they could find a way.
Yeah, well, I highly doubt the government is going to try and stop it happening. The other thing, Tom, which we need to factor into it is the market forces as well, because this will almost certainly negatively impact businesses if they exclude a significant proportion of the population from accessing their business. So it's not good for business to do this on the whole. I think at first maybe they'll think it might be because it might reassure people. But I think in the long term, it will unquestionably be bad for business. And I think that this is also one of the reasons why the tourism industry might not be as affected by this as perhaps we might think. I don't think it's going to be a total shutout of international travel because some...
Well, already some countries have said, Turkey, I think, and Greece have said, we're not going to be, we're not going to be asking for vaccinations.
I mean, if say, I don't know, I've got absolutely no idea what proportion of the world will end up being vaccinated, but say 50% of the world end up getting vaccinated. If you say only vaccinated people can come to my country, you're basically saying that half the world can't visit your country and spend money in your country,
it's more insidious than that though, isn't it, Jimmy? Because the richer people are going to be vaccinated and the poorer people aren't, on the whole. So people aren't going to care. You know, the people who spend money are going to be vaccinated. It's a bit like the same. It's exactly the same as, you know, the middle class in this country. They're the ones who've been locked down and, you know, hiding from the virus. So they don't really see that going out there, the working class are working much as normal because they have to. Yeah. It's going to be exactly the same way. It'll just lead to a greater rich poor divide. I worry.
You may be very right. You may be may very well be right, Tom. But I just think that probably the decision of, say, Greece to say that they're not going to require it, but I would imagine is because so much of their economy is based around tourism, and they can't essentially shut their tourist industry down to people just because they haven't had a coronavirus vaccine.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And to be fair, it makes me want to go to Greece, you know.
It does, yeah. I mean, I fancy. I believe their beaches are very good and their food, of course, is delicious.
I've been there.
Have you? I've got a dream, Jamie, of going sailing around the Greek islands.
Oh, amazing.
I pass my day skipper in the summer. I just need a boat. And if anyone's got a boat who listens to Irreverent, you know.
Give it to Tom.
Give me the keys. I think we've talked about this a lot, and I think we should probably talk, sort of double back a little bit, because we spoke a little bit about sort of totalitarian states, and the fact that we it's very hard now. I think I was going to say very hard now for the UK to say to a totalitarian state, well, we think you should be more free, because, you know, we haven't stuck by the courage of that conviction. We've demonstrated that when push comes to shove, when it comes to it, we will abandon all the things that we want other people to have in the purported quest for safety, regardless of whether this has been effective or not. It's a damaging place to be, because either you stand by these things and say people are free, or you don't. And I've been kind of following the Sarah Everard saga, and it's been really interesting to see, and it kind of ties back in with my sort of middle class, haven't really seen this, to see the middle class commentators howling with rage that a middle class protest has been attacked by the police in some sort of but the hypocrisy is damning, isn't it? You know, we thought that this would be fine because it's obviously a middle class clause that's obviously right, and all those other protests are obviously not right, so therefore the police should have just quite right to have shut them down. I mean, this, you know, they seem to have suddenly woken up to the fact that we are in fact living in what can only be called a police state, and it's quite extraordinary, isn't it? I was actually quite surprised, because I thought the Metropolitan Police wouldn't score their own goal. I expected them to do exactly what the middle class people anticipated, which is just to let it go ahead, because it's a good, you know, good old, because it's, I mean, what do we think about this?
Yeah, there wasn't any bending of the knee, was there? It was quite, I mean, it's an extraordinary awful response. And now we're in this state, this sort of maelstrom of confusion again. It's not,
but why are they confused? I mean, have they not seen it happen?
You can't say on the one hand that you know we want to ban protests and support the banning of protest in the pursuit of a successful lockdown, and then get upset when the police a protest. I mean, it's just hypocritical. And they didn't care when the lockdown protesters were being violently assaulted by the police. They didn't care about our rights then. But they apparently care now, which I think is a double standard personally. And sorry, go on, Tom. Go on.
No, I'm just really quite. I mean, in some ways, I'm quite glad, not because the protest has been split up, because I think that, you know, the whole ban on protesting is manifestly A, unnecessary, B, a complete overreach of government power, and C, frankly. Well, it's an outrage against everything that we stood for as a country. Like, the idea that we can't even protest against the state we're in is pretty much the definition of a police state. But I was just surprised, because my assumption was that the police would do exactly what the middle class thought they would do, and, you know, bend the knee, because it's such an obvious own goal. Because the only people who would have been outraged otherwise, because let's just be honest, there's no COVID risk of people holding a masked, candlelit, socially distanced vigil in Clapham Common. There's no COVID risk at all.
Oh, when I pointed this out, I got plenty of shout back from folks on Twitter telling me it's incredibly risky. Yeah, it's incredible. They were putting lives at risk. And no matter that I, you know, replied saying, I think there's a, it's got a 20th of its infectability outdoors,
In fact, Sir Patrick Vallance himself has said there's very little evidence of outdoor transmission, that it's indoor transmission that matters. And there's recently the whole crowded beaches down here in Bournemouth.
Likewise.
There was no transmission at all through that. So the idea that
vitamin D might actually do rather than, actually do the opposite. At the most safest place to be is probably outside.
Oh yeah, yeah. And I think that's what, you know, Whitty and Vallance have both said. They even said, don't jump into the road to avoid people when you're outside. It's more dangerous to get hit by a car than the purported chance of getting COVID.
You know what? Before I came here, I thought I got very grisly watching going from a country church in the middle of nowhere, passing through, you know, villages and what have yous. And there in this country lane, a mile and a half from anywhere, was a lady walking a dog with a mask. It took me all my effort not to wind down the window and say, what are you protecting yourself from? In the middle of nowhere, there's no one else here.
We all know that the masks are a sign of, it's the rabbit foot of the COVID age, isn't it? You know, it's a sign of obedience to the rules. It's not actually doing anything.
But it might also be because people are so... Their idea of what's going on is so wildly inaccurate that they do genuinely think there might be just COVID sort of floating around in the air in the countryside, and that, you know, it's safer to wear a mask for that reason. It's like a kind of superstitious action, isn't it? I was cycling back home from church today, and these two people were way out in the middle of the road because they were walking around someone. I was thinking, this is, you know, I didn't think what you just said, Tom, but I did think that's quite dangerous, and you're right. I mean, if a car comes around the corner, you know,
there's been advice from our government scientists not to jump into the road. It's actually, you know, please don't do that, they've said. The risks of catching it when you're passing are virtually nil anyway.
Chris Whitty wouldn't do that.
No, he would stay on the pavement. But the point is, of course, that there's no COVID risk. The scientists have said that, you know, publicly. So I mean, that's the case for most of these protests anyway. All of them, you could argue. I guess the lockdown protests probably socially distanced less, but I'm not convinced there was much social distancing going on in the beach in Bournemouth. That I know there wasn't, because I was there. But the point is, I expected Cressida Dick and her, you know, minions to go, actually, we probably shouldn't come down on this one with the batons raised, because you know, the press is going to be so awful, because all they're going to annoy then, if they just let it happen, all the only people they'd annoy are the lockdown skeptics, are annoyed anyway. So, but as it is, they came in with batons raised against this vigil, and at least it's shown the world just how illiberal and how fallen our state of this.
She had a most bizarre comment the following day, didn't she? Did you see the press?
No, I didn't. She's
press statement.
Well, she's been called to resign, hasn't she? She's refused to thus far.
Yeah, but she made in front of the press. She said that her officers acted because there was clearly a gathering that was unsafe to the general public, or something to those words. You know, it was essentially very unsafe what was happening, so we needed to break it up.
Very unsafe.
But the thing is the government have thrown her under the bus, haven't they? I mean, I think...
haven't they called them in to explain their actions? Why you're following the laws we wrote.
Yeah, the Metropolitan Police have been disgraceful, I think, so I'm not defending them. I don't mean recently, I just mean in general.
Oh, no, I agree, but it's the government's...
The government acting like they've got nothing to do with this is absolutely outrageous. They're the ones who have passed the laws, and the police are the ones who are enforcing them. So you could argue that the police are in a really difficult position because they can either ignore the law or enforce an unjust law. And that's the invidious position the police are in, and the government have put them in that position. Yet when something happens that actually reflects poorly on the government and their stupid lockdown laws, they throw the police under the bus. It's absolutely outrageous.
That's ridiculous.
Moral hypocrisy is—it stinks.
And I think I'd like to see this done with every single COVID regulation. And you know, the fact that it's not done, it speaks volumes, I think. But every single one, the guidance. The guidance they've been given by the scientists needs to be put next to it, to be honest. I really want to see exactly why they have banned protests, what the scientists think this has done, and why the government think it's so important to shut down such an important part of our democratic right, that needs to be done. You know, they need to justify every single one. And I think they've not done any of this, not bothered at any point. The justification they give is a single line in each legislation that's there at the beginning of every single one, which just says the Secretary of State for Health thinks that these are necessary.
I think you said Secretary of Hate.
Secretary of State for Health,
Freudian slip, I
think. thinks that these are necessary for the controlling of the pandemic. That's their justification. But they really need to go further than that if they're going to take away our fundamental rights, and they don't. And it's annoyed me throughout. And but especially this one. You know, the government ministers have done a number of things to make policing harder for the police, and I think the police haven't helped themselves. But the government have conflated guidance, which is not legally mandatory, with law on a number of occasions. And indeed, ministers have even made up their own law on occasion. Famously, it was Michael Gove, wasn't it, who proclaimed that you should only do one bit of exercise a day. That didn't appear in either the law or the guidance.
Yeah, it's just their preference. Yeah, I mean, Tom, just to drop this in, a lot of this is clearly nothing to do with public health, and we can see this with this crime bill that the police are trying to bring in now. So this is exactly what people like us have been saying is going to happen. They will arrogate the powers to themselves under the pretext that they're going to give the powers back, and then they will keep hold of the powers. And this is a textbook example of that, because they've taken away the right to protest, and now they're passing a law which will effectively retain that power for the government, and will mean that organizing a protest is effectively impossible. Because with this new bill, there's a clause in it which says that if your protest is even risks the possibility of causing serious annoyance, you could be arrested and you could be imprisoned for 10 years. This is effectively a banning of protest. Now they're trying to get the Tory
faithful on side by saying that this is because they want to crack down on groups like Black Lives Matter. But it's not. It's about the government retaining that power, which they took away from us last year. They've got every intention of trying to stop protests permanently. And that's what this bill is. It's explicit. It's explicit in the bill.
Maybe they could call this the Emperor Palpatine law. I love democracy. Kill them all.
Yeah, I mean, this is how democracy dies, not with a bang, but with applause, isn't it? That's a face.
Good line, yeah. But Priti Patel, I mean, she just, I don't follow her on Twitter, but I saw a tweet she put out, like, boasting about this. And it was like, on the one, you know, it was a shot, it was a photograph, and on the one side of it was, like, people protesting. And then was the other, her in, like, a business suit, striking a power pose. And you think, what kind of person has that sort of self-image? That they'd like tweet a picture of themselves like that, you know, boasting about their new fascist police and crime bill. I mean, it is seriously worrying. It's like reminiscent of a kind of Nazi propaganda.
What is it about the 10-year thing? Remember, it was 10 years.
Yeah, they love this. They love the idea.
Your family might be 10 years in prison along paedophiles. Murder, yes, manslaughter, serious manslaughter.
I mean, it's any number they know, isn't it? It's £10,000, 10 years.
All the 10 years. It's like a symbolic thing, like in the Book of Revelation. It just means forever.
10 years. But you know.
I wanted to mention this, chaps. Who is it? Sorry, let's get it right. Let's name her properly. It's not loading up now. Baroness, is it somebody from the Green Party? Oh, yes, Baroness Jones from the Green Party has suggested that because a man has killed, murdered a woman, which is very tragic, and I don't want to make light of it, but. That is essentially what's happened. One man has done something awful. She's suggesting that there should be a 6 p.m. curfew on all men in order to keep women safe at night. Mr. Drakeford, so this was in Wales, so Mark Drakeford has told the BBC, it wouldn't be on the top of the list of things we'd consider because it would be at the very best a temporary intervention.
Okay, a temporary ban. Do you know, I have a feeling that most violence against women occurs at home anyway, doesn't it? I mean, obviously, this is a tragic outdoor stalking, kidnap, murder. But I have a feeling that most of it happens behind the doors of the family home. Arguably, it should be the other way around. Actually, to be fair, to be absolutely safe for a woman, you should probably just round up men and lock them in a prison.
Cage them, yeah.
It's the only way.
Escape from New York City. So a whole disaster films.
The other thing about this 6 p.m. thing is this psychopath who killed this woman, is he the kind of person who's going to respect a 6 p.m. curfew? Who think, I was going to go out and do something awful, but I'll just stay at home instead.
What's the police officer?
Yeah, well, we should be clear, not that anyone probably listens to us who would sue us, but it's allegedly... a metropolitan police officer. I think he's been arrested and charged, but obviously innocent until proven guilty. But that's what it seems to be.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? Again, if you think about the irony of what this, here we've got a hereditary peer from the Green Party, which itself seems a bit of a.
Well, I'm not quite sure why they let them have only hereditary peers. Who's promoting these people?
I didn't think that would be the sort of thing that Greens went for, really.
Do you know, Jamie, you made a really good point.
That half the population should be locked down for all eternity after 6 o'clock.
Yeah. I'm pretty knackered anyway, to be honest with you.
I know. There's a part of me that thinks... I could get some great
good night's sleep. Eat as much cereal as you like, then, couldn't you?
Stay at home, stuffing your face with Cocoa Pops.
Can you imagine all the sort of Amazon delivery and Tesco delivery vans going to his house? I think like that bit in Blade Runner, you know, where he's having the Chinese takeaway and it pans back. It's actually a floating takeaway. We'd have to have thousands of these.
I love
These vendors coming to our windows.
Yeah. I think, Jamie, you made a really good point when we were walking the other day, and you said that this would never have been thinkable.
Yeah.
Unless we had been in lockdown already. You know, it's known as the Overton window, which is the idea that, you know, public discourse follows a certain sort of clustered a cluster of what is acceptable, and lockdown has moved that Overton window severely towards the authoritarian, yeah. where we can have. To be honest, I think Green Party are pretty dilally anyway, so maybe they would have said this before. But no. The idea that it can seriously—I mean, Mark Drakeford is an elected politician. The idea that he could seriously say, "Oh, you know, this would only be a temporary measure." Yeah. Not the highest on our list, rather than that's an absurd thing to say. Yeah. It's only because we've been in lockdown for a year that this could be thinkable. And again, you know, this is how the public discourse changes. This is how convention, which once protected us, now no longer protects us. And we are without, you know, we're at a point where an elected official can muse that wouldn't be the most ideal thing to do. But, you know, if it was only temporary.
I know, Jamie, you've been reading Peterson. I've been reading Lewis, The Abolition of Man.
Yeah.
And then I've gone over the Hideous Strength dystopian novel that it's based on. As extraordinary sense, and he's so apposite. He's such a prophet of the time. I think this particular book was 1943, I think, when he wrote it. Yeah. Or a series of essays, really beginning with education and then going through this idea of the pretty much we're seeing a healthcare technocracy based on the idea that, to use his sort of inexclusive language, you know, once man has conquered nature, once we get into that mindset that nature is something to be conquered and dominated, we shall go to the logical conclusion of that, which is the conquering of ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, we shall amputate our humanity and become men without chests. But we will only be able to do that if the controllers, if we appoint a series of controllers who can, whose only real claim to authority over us is expertise.
Yeah.
That expertise, you know, that word, the experts, comes over again. But I really recommend reading it, actually, if listeners get the chance. It's quite a haunting piece. And I think he's actually, I like Brave New World and I like Orwell's, I find them compelling. But I think actually he's probably more accurate. He's seeing a vision of what we could be, which is somewhere in between the two.
Yeah.
Since March the 23rd, I think we've locked into it last year. That's my.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
Really bugs me.
It's remarkable, isn't it? And that Hideous Strength, I think, also is very insightful as well, isn't it? Sorry, Tom.
I can certainly see Chris Whitty in, what's like nice, aren't they?
The
two perfect acronyms of the government party. Then, you know, SAGE, nice. It's worth a read if anyone hasn't read it. Who's listening to us? The whole trilogy is interesting, actually. Yeah. But I think that's Hideous Strength. You don't need to have read the other two. I think it's fair to say.
You can do.
You can read it on its own.
This is a good passage I've got here in my notes from The Abolition of Man. He writes, at the moment then of man's victory over nature, we find the whole human race subjected to some individual men, and those individuals subjected to that in themselves, which is purely, in inverted commas, natural, to their irrational impulses. Nature, untrammeled by values, rules the conditioners, and through them, all humanity. I think that's very powerful, isn't it? Yep. The idea that we're actually, you know, we're really being ruled by the irrational impulses, irrational natural impulses of the technocrats who we've yielded our. It's essentially we've yielded our humanity to them, and I think this is one of the key things here is that this issue of freedom
is so important in terms of moral responsibility. And I'm sure I've said this on the pod before, but it's something that is the main theme of Dostoevsky's parable of the Grand Inquisitor, the idea that Christ is condemned by the Inquisitor because he came to give human beings freedom, which entails moral responsibility. And this is how we are truly human. It's by being free enough to take responsibility for our own actions. And actually what the Inquisitor wants to do is he wants to enslave human beings so they won't have the anxiety that's produced by having moral responsibility. And that, I fear, is the kind of Faustian pact that we've made as a result of handing over our freedoms, or in the action rather of handing over our freedoms to the government. But chaps, one of the other things I want to just, I mean, I think we should probably finish in a minute, but one of the things I think it's important here when talking about this thing about curfews for men and things like that is the worrying view of masculinity that it entails, that men are basically kind of dangerous animals that need to be caged. And it is, I don't know how it fits into the whole transgender thing. I mean, I asked the question on Twitter, will transgender women be subjected to this 5 p.m. or 6 p.m. curfew as well? Because that to me sort of would be a serious problem with it. I mean, amongst others, obviously. But you know, I think the problem, firstly, let's say this, one man murdering a woman, I don't think entails that some kind of crisis of masculinity in itself. But nevertheless, there is a crisis of masculinity in our culture, for sure. And the whole idea of masculinity and indeed femininity is problematized in so many ways. But my strong belief is that the way of solving the problem of masculinity is not to either pretend that there's no such thing as masculinity, or that it's entirely evil and dangerous and that men should just be put in cages. It would be to give men back their traditional identity of protector and provider, because that's what's been withheld by modern culture, particularly recently. And it's become even taboo even to imply this. But men, I think the reason that men are so aimless and in some cases violent and dangerous is because they haven't been given that identity, or rather that identity has actually been taken away from them. So they no longer think, I am strong, you know, I'm physically stronger than most women, and I'm physically stronger than children, and my physical strength is a gift from God, or, you know, if you're not thinking about in religious terms, you know, a natural gift that I possess, which I'm given for the purpose of protecting the weak and the vulnerable. And that's part of my identity as a man. You know, it's not that I'm fighting off marauding Vikings from outside my house, but that is fundamentally my responsibility. I have a responsibility to use my physical strength to the extent that it's necessary and appropriate to protect the vulnerable. And that's been withheld from men. And it's inevitable that that physical strength will be used in perverse ways as a result.
I think you've got some truth there. I mean, I've plucked up my Book of Common Prayer because this conversation has reminded me of something in the Solemnization of Matrimony, which is no longer read out very often because I think it taps into another thing that goes hand in hand with that, which is an acknowledgement of the necessity of God's grace to control masculine inputs, you know. And it says here that the matrimony shouldn't be taken in hand unadvisedly, lightly or wantonly, to satisfy men's carnal lusts and appetites like brute beasts that have no understanding, but reverently, discreetly, advisedly, soberly, and in the fear of God. And that's the other half of the coin, isn't it? On the one hand, to be reminded of our duty as protectors, and on the other hand, to be reminded of our need for the grace of God for that to work. Yeah. The two go hand in hand. You know, they control, you know, masculinity is balanced between those two things, between wisdom and action. Yeah. Between, you know, I don't think you can have both. You can't have either.
Yeah, there's a thing in there's a thing that's easily missed in the translation of the Beatitudes, that blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. But the meek isn't Uriah Heep. The Greek word escapes me at the moment, but it is it's the same word that's used for restraining a horse or sheathing a sword.
Mm.
I think in you're going to have a look, aren't you, Tom, and embarrass me, but it could translation of it would be, you know, blessed is the man who keeps his sword in his sheath. I think Jordan Peterson's done a whole bit on this. In terms of, you know, it's about those who know their strength but are able to appropriately channel it.
Yeah, that reminds me very strongly of something. Do you know Edward King, the 19th century Bishop of Lincoln, who was principal of our theological college for 10 years, but he I think is a great man, a great saint really. But he defined in one of his sermons, he defines gentleness as controlled strength. And that really, and he, it might've been in the sermon on the book of Samuel, thy gentleness has made me great. Mm. And that's how he defines gentleness, is controlled strength. And I think that's akin to what you're saying.
Yeah.
Tom, have you got the answer?
The word is praise. No, yeah. Just
yeah.
Which, yes.
I'd have spoken utter rubbish, but
I'm sure. I like the idea of keeping your sword in its sheath. Yes, that's appropriately phallic. Listen, before we go too far down the Greek Bible study. We could maybe have a little podcast extra for special listeners, but I think I'm going to have to go because I'm desperate for the loo. I'd like to read out just an email. So I said I was going to do an email of the week. So I've decided to read out an email by a young lady who would prefer to remain nameless. And she writes, "Hello, I'm a Christian who attends the Scottish Episcopal Church. I was so happy to find a lockdown skeptical podcast presented by British clergy. Most of what I've heard comes from American preachers. All the clergy I know in real life are very vehemently pro-lockdown. Our churches have been shut for months up here in Haggisland. It is particularly painful for me because I have autism. Before the lockdown, I was making genuine progress with social skills, and church was a big part of that. Now I've regressed back to square one. I'm curious to know, have you had any pushback from within the church?" And she writes, "To express views like yours would be social suicide in the Scottish church. Keep fighting the good fight." So all the feedback I've received has been overwhelmingly positive. I've hardly had anyone say anything negative at all to me about being on this podcast. And all the emails I get are really, they're really positive, and they're similar to that, expressing thanks and happiness that we exist, basically. So I don't know, Tom, have you got any pushback?
I've not had any pushback. No, I've had some positive stuff. I know Daniel's been called a rascal by the Archbishop, so I mean that's pretty hard.
Another sleepless night. Another sleepless night.
The only pushback you've had has been from the Archbishop of Canterbury, who called you a rascal. That's absolutely brilliant. And we're really sorry about this. Obviously, we feel terrible about the situation with your autism as well. And again, it's one of those hidden costs of the lockdown, and it's the church is failing people. That's, you know, that's all that can be said. You know, people with autism who make progress in social skills by being involved in a church community, that's not been happening for a year, and it has an effect on people. So we have a responsibility. The church has a responsibility, and it's really sad to hear. Anyway, chaps, I think we should probably leave it there. Any last words for the podcast from anyone?
I was just going to say that looking up Dan's exegesis of meek is absolutely correct. It's a word that means not weakness, but exercising strength with control. So there we are. That's good.
Fantastic. That's great. Well, it's good to know that Daniel's Greek is obviously polishing.
25 years since the last looks.
He's obviously polishing that in the study every day.
I'd like to end with Double Dutch from the Archbishop of Canterbury.
This is for our podcast listeners. This is, I don't know, can we put a link
to
that?
It's
surreal.
Jimmy, can you follow it and share your screen for a moment just to end, or...
Well, I can. Hang on a second.
There's somebody on Twitter who used the Wombo app and very methodically has done not only all the diocesan bishops, who have to say, apparently, So far, many of them in good spirit have thought it's hilarious. And the Archbishop of York was very jealous that he wasn't on it. And then subsequently, a day later, was morphed. So Williams has been added, as is Robert Runcie and King Charles I. So.
Wow. So the Wombo app basically makes, you take a photo of someone and it makes that photograph.
Yeah, stay still for a minute. No, I'm only joking.
It makes that photograph move around as though the person is singing.
Yeah.
Is it always the same song? Is it?
No, there is a range of stuff.
Well, I thought it was very disturbing. particularly with bishops who I've met, such as the Bishop of Winchester, there's something kind of, it's like they look like reanimated corpses. Don't you wish your girlfriend was hot like me? It's really weird.
It's a sort of uncanny valley thing, isn't it? Which is known as this is too close to being human, but not quite human enough, and our brains get very confused by it.
There's Rowan Williams singing "I Will Survive."
Well, that is, I mean, I can imagine him doing that anyway.
he's got a very good singing voice, apparently.
I
think when he was younger, he used to do a lot of singing.
Not like this.
No, slightly different. Yeah, different genre. Anyway, chaps, I think let's leave it there, shall we? God bless all our listeners. Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed the episode. Please send us an email, irreverendpod@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter, irreverendpod. And you can leave us a rating and review on iTunes, or if that's possible, wherever you get your podcast, please do that. And yes, thanks so much, chaps. That was good. I enjoyed that. And I'll see you, well, probably at some point, but yeah, definitely next. Yeah. All right, bye now.